From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
Delighted to say my guest today is Martin Woodward, and you've been diving for, 50 years.
50 years, yeah. 50 years, men and boys, so they say.
Do you remember your first dive?
I do, yeah, because in the good old days, as we say, you tended to just go and teach yourself. I mean, I was always a bit of a water baby when I was a kid. I was down in this area that you can see out of the window. I grew up in this area as a young teenager, and that involved going out in boats and snorkeling around the ledges and everything. And it's a natural progression then to go and buy a few bits of old kit and go and discover the seabed a bit deeper. And that's what happened, really. And then that led on to commercial diving and things later on. But it was fantastic as a kid here, because you could just go out on the ledges and find all sorts of bits. It didn't have to be valuable, but whatever you retrieve from the deep, is you've wrenched it from the grasp of the ocean. It's just that small boy feeling, you know, that you've achieved something. It's just great.
It's a marvellous view here, because you can see so many ships, can't you? It must be one of the biggest, sort of most busiest seaways in the world, mustn't it?
It is. They say the English Channel is definitely the most busy waterway in the world. But of course, the Eastern Solent and Spithead here are always busy, because all the cruise ships come out and come in this way, and all the merchant ships come here. A lot anchor, as you can see, and they wait for their orders to go in. So there's always something going on, and it's lovely to be able to see it all going on out of the window.
You've dived on about 700 wrecks, haven't you?
Yeah, I haven't counted them, but a lot of people ask me that question, and that's my rough estimate. It could be more, it could be slightly less, but it's certainly around about that. And that's just not around the Isle of Wight, it's around the world, basically. So,
we have talked about the Mendy in a previous programme, but I know you discovered a submarine as well, didn't you?
Yes, well, more than one, actually. The main one, the most significant one in my view, is the HMS Swordfish, which I found in 1983, completely by surprise. I had no idea, nor did anybody else have any idea, that it was off the Isle of Wight, which made it even more of a mystery. And that's why it sort of hit the national press, because it solved a mystery of World War II. Just briefly, the HMS Swordfish left Gosport on the 7th of November 1940, and she was intending to take up a position off the west coast of France to patrol the western approaches and intercept any enemy shipping. Now, in those days, because of radio silence, they didn't contact the other submarine that they were relieving in that position off Brest, 250 miles from here, which was the HMS Usk. But they just had a predetermined time to be there, and they just relieved each other. The other submarine came back, and everybody assumed that the Swordfish had reached that position off Brest. It hadn't, because what happened, and nobody knew, obviously, was that it came out of Gosport, went down to St. Catherine's, carried out what they call a trim dive, where they just go submerge and trim the boat to get it right for steaming underwater during the night. And they then would come up and surface and proceed down channel in darkness on the surface, and then resubmerge when they get to the other end. When she did her trim dive off St. Catherine's, she hit a German mine, and it blew it in half and obviously killed all the 40 crew aboard, which was tragic. But as I say, no one knew about it. And it was a total surprise when I actually came across it while I was looking for another wreck in 1983.
Do you get so excited when you discover something you didn't know was there? It must be a terrific feeling.
It's a wonderful feeling, especially when there's some significance historically, and also with the Swordfish, it developed a real human element, because those 40 crew that died, obviously no one knew they died, because no one got out. Well, there may have been a couple of people got out of the after end of it, because there was only one hatch open right at the very back of the submarine. And maybe a couple of the motormen survived the blast. I mean, the blast just blew the submarine in half just forward of the conning tower. So all the people in the control room and the forward end would have died instantly. But someone may have got out. But of course, you know, there are probably bodies everywhere floating around the channel. Unless they had some ID on them, they wouldn't have been identified if they were ever found. But to answer the question, it's to me, every wreck has a story, and every item has a story. Everything you recover has a story. Unless you can unravel that story, the item is not really worth anything. Or not, I'm not talking about monetary value, but historic value is much more when you've got the story behind it. So to unravel the story of the swordfish and see the human element of 235 people turned up in November 83 to a memorial service in HMS Dolphin at Gosport, and that's six people per person from 43 years later. It just shows people don't forget. And then you develop the relationship with the relatives of the crew, which brings the story alive.
Among your other pursuits in your life, I know we're sat right opposite the recently new lifeboat station at Bembridge. You were the coxswain, second coxswain and then first coxswain.
I was a crewman for 30-something years, including the coxswain, second coxswain. I was coxswain, second coxswain for a total of 20 years, just about. I think it was 10 years as second coxswain and 9 years as coxswain. As you can see by looking out the window, you've got no excuse to miss it, have you, really? Because the shortest commute ever, you just run along the seawall to the pier. Obviously, it was a much smaller pier in those days. The new one was built in 2000, finished in 2010. But it was great. You know, we had a lot of good years on the lifeboat, and I enjoyed doing it. We carried out some memorable rescues.
Have you got one or two that stick in your mind, Martin?
Yes, there's always a couple that stick in your mind. I remember some of the hoaxes we had in the early 70s where you would be out in a horrendous night, you know, amusing some sort of strange person who wanted to put out a false May Day, and you'd be out there for 20 hours in a force 9 or 10 banging around in the channel just because some idiot had put out a thing. So those things are memorable. We had a few of those over the years, but as far as the rescues are concerned, the one that sticks in my mind is the Paul Fisher, which was a coaster which sank in November 79 in a really nasty storm. It was down off St. Catharines, quite a few miles south of St. Catharines, southwest of St. Catharines. And that was probably one of the most memorable ones for me because it was quite a bad night. And sadly, 13 of the crew died on that. Only two survivors, two young lads.
Two hurricanes as well.
Yeah, two hurricanes. We were on standby, sitting on the boat, ready to go on the 1987 hurricane. A ship called the Union Mars had taken waves right through the wheelhouse down in the channel. And we were asked to go and sit on the boat and ready to go. Yarmouth came up through the Solent, Yarmouth lifeboat. Because the Coast Guards wanted us to go in tandem. We understand their point of view, but we were quite happy to go on our own, and so were Yarmouth. I'm sure they would have been happy to go the other way around, and because the boats were all-weather boats, the lifeboats. We didn't actually go in the end because the ship got up into the Solent under its own steam by the time we were ready to go, and all was well. The second one was the January 90 hurricane, which was just a false alarm, but we went out in that one, and I've never seen conditions, none of us had seen conditions like that in the Solent. It was blowing an absolute hooli, and I've got a wonderful bit of video of that that the helicopter took, and you think it was in the Southern Ocean, not out by the forts here. And sadly, as a result of that storm, there was a ship called the Flag Theophano sunk just out here, 3 miles off, and drowned all 19 of the crew, I think it was. A cement carrying ship capsized literally just over there, just where I'm pointing. That was in January 1990.
Did you ever sort of feel scared at any time?
No, I don't think so. Maybe I'm a bit dumb. I don't know. But no, it's confidence in the boats. I mean, I always harp on about. You think back to the old historic lifeboats we've got and the old Queen Victoria, the rowing lifeboat that we've got, and I've been out in that and we've rowed it. And it makes you think about those old buoys, which I knew when I was a kid, and it's what inspired me to get involved with the lifeboat. Both my neighbours and the Attrell brothers, you know, they were the old boys. They're very old men when I was a young lad, but they were actually crewed in that old lifeboat, and their father was the coxswain. And they told me these stories, these hair-raising stories about going out there and rowing in these storms and in an open boat. And they were heroic people. I mean, what we did by comparison was insignificant. I mean, I'm not taking away the, you know, you get thrown around a bit in a modern lifeboat, but at the end of the day, you've got engines underneath you and you're not rowing by physical manpower like they were. And I will always have a huge respect for those old boys.
I met an old guy once that was on the Brook
lifeboat. Yeah, that would be one of the cooks, or was it the old guy from Freshwater?
Yeah, and amazing. Yeah. I don't know how they did it, really.
They were amazing, especially on the back of the island, because they were exposed to that southwesterly wind and launching off the beach. I mean, I've got lots of pictures of some of those old lifeboats at Brook, Bryston and Atherfield, and they did some tremendous work down there. And they lost some of their people. I mean, on the Sirenia rescue in 1888, they lost the coxswain and the second coxswain off the Bryston lifeboat, and they lost the second coxswain off the Brook lifeboat. They were washed overboard and drowned, and people don't remember that. These people gave up their lives. And funnily enough, there's a great story about that, because the coxswain from here, Joey Attrell, you know, he was a tremendous man. And as I say, I knew his sons. They were my neighbours when I was a kid. And he walked all the way to Atherfield to volunteer to go out in the boats and rescue the remaining crew on the Sirenia. And he was on the third launch, and they went out and rescued the rest of the crew. And the mayor of Newport awarded him 10 shillings for that. A great story.
When you look out and see the posh ramp where they come out now, yeah, I suppose, I mean, the old boys would have said, oh, that's easy to what we did, wouldn't they?
Exactly, they would. And that's why I say that you must never forget those people of the old days. I mean, even in my era, I did my first service launch in August 1965, just before I went to sea. I went to sea in the Merchant Navy, and in those days, I mean, I remember the coxswain saying to me, because he was a great guy to me, Peter Smith. He was a mentor, and I spent a lot of time with him as a kid. And he said to me, "You're going to be a navigator." He said, "You're going to sea to be a navigator." He said, "Go down below and navigate where we are this dark night off here, only in the Solent."
Yeah.
And you know what was there? There was nothing. They just put a radar on the boat, but I think that was before the radar was put on. And I went down below and couldn't even find a pencil. Nowadays, it's all electronics, yeah, potters, computers. You know, GPS, you know exactly where you are. So it makes you wonder how people got on in the very old days.
I'll never forget interviewing Colin Smith, the late Colin Smith,
yeah,
in 1948 when they crossed the Atlantic. And I said to him, "What did you wear?" And he said, "Well, sports jacket and flannels." And they had no harness, no lifeboat, nothing. And they crossed the Atlantic, you know.
Yeah.
It's remarkable, isn't it?
It is. There's a lovely story about a chap called Pip Morgan who I talk about him. I've got a picture of him, them, the three young people setting off in a little ex-Morecambe Bay prawner, a little sailing boat. They got as far as Sandra. They were sailing to America, and they got into trouble off here and were rescued by the Langham lifeboat. And there's many, many stories. When you said Colin Smith, I thought you were talking about the Colin Smith that was on the crew with me. It was Peter Smith's son.
This was the Smith brothers, wasn't
you're
it?
You're talking about the Smith
Colin
brothers.
Colin and Stan,
different Colin Smith.
Yeah.
But there's some great stories, really, when you go back and look through.
Colin sort of went overboard. Something happened and he went overboard. He had no life jacket, no harness or anything like that on. And he said to me, the waves were quite big and the ship disappeared, the boat disappeared. And he said, "I can remember shouting to Stan, 'Stan, I've never seen her on the ocean. She looks lovely from here.'" And by sheer luck, he jibed the boat round, yeah. I think, and he managed just to grab the rail and get back on board.
Yeah, lucky man.
Can't believe it.
Yeah, lucky man. A lot of people get lost overboard.
You've written a book about the Bembridge lifeboat, haven't you?
Yeah, I did it. I started it about 25 years ago, and as is always the case with me, I quite like writing, but I've got a lot to write about with the wrecks and diving and everything, but it's getting the time to do it because I'm still actively doing things and still actively diving. And I keep saying I'm going to do that when I'm older. And, of course, here I am still diving at nearly 70 years old. But, yes, I wrote a book. For the RNLI wanted to bring out a standardised, like 180 pages book for the stations. I think they've got up to about 6 or 7 stations around the coast now. I think we were about number 5, and I said, well, I've already written most of it, so I might as well do it. And so I did it year before last, and it came out last year, I think it was, or year before. No, last year, I think it was, and it's on sale down at the RNLI. It's all proceeds go to the RNLI, and it's down on sale down at the RNLI shop.
And also at your museum,
yeah,
I guess.
I think we've got a couple at the museum, but we have sold a few at the museum.
That's at Arrowton Barnes, of course.
At Arrowton, at the Shipwreck Centre, yeah.
Yeah. You've got something special in mind, haven't you? A cycle ride?
Oh, yeah. a bit of an adrenaline junkie, so I'm told by the family. Yeah, I've done a fair bit of long-distance cycling. I've done New Zealand, top to bottom, and South Africa and Western Australia, Vietnam, Cambodia, John O'Groats, Land's End. Most of them in my 60s, I might add. But to mark my 70th birthday, I'm going to cycle with my mate, who I did with New Zealand and South Africa with, around Ireland from Dublin to Dublin. So that'll be a nice little way of having a challenge for your birthday, isn't it?
Really? How long will that take you then, Martin?
About 10 years. No. We've sort of allowed about 3 weeks. It's about 1,500 miles, roughly, because, you know, you don't plan every stop. It's just an itinerary that we've roughly put together and see how it goes. The wonderful thing about it is we do everything self-supporting. So you've got your tents with you on the bike. There's no support whatsoever. You just got everything in the panniers on the bike. And that's the way we did New Zealand. And that took 7 or 8 weeks, I think. Top to bottom, 2,000-something miles. It's great because it's that wonderful freedom of every day is not really planned until you do it. You might think the day before we'll go so-and-so and have a rough route, but you stop when you've done whatever mileage, you know, if you do 70 miles, 80 miles or whatever, and then you camp and you cook up your food, or if you want to really treat yourself, you go to a B&B. But it's lovely. It's a lovely way of seeing a place. We tried to do Ireland back in 2007, but unfortunately my mate, his mother got taken ill, so we had to come back after a couple of days, actually. So it's completing unfinished business. I'm looking forward to it because I've been working really hard this year, and it'd be nice to actually get on that bike and get a bit of time of not thinking about what the next job is.
I just noticed your T-shirt, Old Guys Rule.
Well, yeah, that's my motto.
Two of us together then.
Yeah.
What do you do right away from diving and lifeboats? Have you got any other sort of interest in life? You've just got married, by the way, haven't you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I did. And I always feel sorry for people who say they're bored. I could never be bored in life, and I'm sure you're the same. You know, you've always got something to do. If you've got an active mind, there's 1,000 things that I would want to do. I mean, my problem is time, and it's probably the same for you, because if you're a busy person, you don't get time to do everything you want to do. But, yeah, I mean, I like any activity, you know, any challenge. You know, I've done a few. You like running. I used to love running, you know, and cycling, anything that's active. But I still enjoy what I do with the, you know, going out and finding wrecks and diving and anything like that, any water sports. You know, a lot of my old North Sea diving colleagues, I met up with one the other day, he said, you're still diving at your age. He said, all the rest of us gave up 30 years ago. And I said, but why did you give up? Why would you give up? I mean, yeah, okay, you give up the North Sea and the oil rigs and all that stuff, that boring stuff, but why give it up? There's no reason to give it up until you physically can't do it anymore. And that's, I always say that the day I give up diving is when they pull me out with rigor mortis, I think.
Yeah. Did you go down to the Mary Rose all those years ago?
No, it's funny. It's a question I'm asked very often. And the reason I didn't was I did a lot of work, projects over in subsequent years with Margaret Rule, who was involved in the Dr. Margaret Rule. We got on really well and we did projects abroad. But the reason I didn't was that I had a lot of stuff going on at the time with doing my own wrecks, because, you know, I'd bought equipment that you could locate wrecks, and I was locating so many wrecks off the Isle of Wight at that time that I didn't have time, and also I didn't want to get involved in a project with so many people involved. The only association we had with that was that myself and colleagues in the commercial diving, we actually laid the anchors for the big barge that picked up the Mary Rose, the Tog Moor, and we put the anchor pattern down and did that, but we didn't actually ever dive. I never dived on the Mary Rose.
You and I could ask a similar question quite often. When are you going to retire? Yeah. I've got no plans. No, you've got no plans.
I think you and I have the same answer on that. I don't think I'll ever retire, because it's nothing to do with earning money. It's to do with what you want to do in life. And the last thing I want to do is sit and watch television or twiddle my thumbs and think, what am I going to do today? I could fill up every day with... And I get so frustrated because I haven't got enough days to do all the things that you want to do in life. And I think probably a lot of people have that philosophy, and that's why they live a bit longer. Fingers crossed that'll work.
I know we talked about the Mendy before. Just before you go, the Mendy was an amazing experience for you in 1974, wasn't it, really?
It was. I mean, it's as I said before, it's one of the most significant wrecks I ever found, because it unraveled this hugely... tragic and poignant story about all these people, and you know, that from the townships of South Africa that were giving their lives, if you like, or you know, the chances of losing their lives by volunteering to become part of this South African Native Labour Corps. But the sad thing was, they were treated really badly. They weren't recognised for what they did. They weren't allowed to carry a gun. And I feel very strongly about that, because if they were fighting for the same cause, you know, why weren't they allowed to carry a gun? Well, the argument was that they might, you know, shoot the white man. But that was a terrible attitude to have. And as a consequence of that, they were only allowed to dig trenches and drive lorries and cook things and build things. And they weren't recognised for even that until recently. And I think it's very significant that they are at last being recognised for what they did. And as I mentioned, I'm going down to the townships in November to meet some of the descendants of the people that were lost on the Mendy. Very sad story.
When you watch the recent play, I felt slightly embarrassed to be white because of how they treated the black South Africans, in a way. It was quite sad, wasn't it?
Oh, it was. It was really, really sad. I mean, obviously, it's very difficult to say when you don't live in South Africa. I mean, they have problems down there, but the way they were treated overall was pretty appalling, I think. And thankfully, things have changed a bit. I did a bike ride across South Africa quite a few years ago now, and we experienced quite a lot of that at that time. Of, you know, that same sort of feeling still existing even these years later. I mean, when the Mendy sank, obviously it was pre-apartheid, but it was apartheid. You know, it was exactly the same thing, and they were just treated very, very badly, I think. They're very sad.
And over 600 died.
646. Yeah, there's many different accounts of how many died. Of the black troops, I think it was over 600, but if you included the whole loss of life, it was 646. Off the Isle of Wight, can you imagine it? You can imagine how shocked I was when I found out the whole story.
I know people ask you if you ever saw any bones there, don't they?
They do. It's a very, very common question, especially with kids that visit the museum. Do you ever find any bodies? Well, yeah, I found a few bodies in my time, you know, on not only with the lifeboat, but with diving, you know, with people having accidents and, you know, going down with boats and things. On the wrecks, you know, going back in historical wrecks, if you like, that not recent wrecks, very rarely do you find bones. Occasionally, but You know, the Mendi is a classic example. People say there were 646 people. Did you find any bodies? I never found one bone on the Mendi. And the reason for that is that bones decalcify if they're subject to tidal movement or hard seabed where they can't get buried. They just decalcify. And that's what happened with the Mendi. It sank on a hard seabed. The tide rushes one way 6 hours and rushes back the other way 6 hours. You've got all the surface turbulence, you know, which even does project down to that depth, you know, and movement. And obviously, they just powered away to nothing. I never saw one bone on that.
Wow. Got a dream for something, an adventure that you haven't done yet, other than cycling around Ireland, or not really?
Well, yeah, the cycling still appeals to me. And yeah, there's a few bits in the world that I'd still like to do. I've done a few bits, but yeah, there's many, many. There's a bucket list as long as your arm, you can imagine that. And in the next 10 years, before I get too ancient, I intend to do as many of those things as I possibly can. I think you've got to have a sense of adventure to keep your mind active, really.
Martin, it's been a great thrill to talk to you, and congratulations on a fantastic life. And you've rescued lots of people over the years, to which we're all very grateful, really.
Yeah, team effort. You know, it's like I always say, you know, you with the lifeboat, it's a team effort of some 30 people, and that includes not only the people that go out on the boat, but the people on shore. That you can't go out without someone knocking the pin out and letting you down the slipway and bringing you back up it. So yeah, it's it was a good time.
Is there a rivalry between Yarmouth and Benbridge, or is it all light-hearted?
Well, not with me. I mean, we're all good friends. You do get this around the coast where you get what I call patchism, and I disagree with that entirely. If you're the bloke in the water, you don't care whether it's the helicopter, the lifeboat, Yarmouth, Selsey or Benbridge that comes to get you, as long as someone comes to get you. So, no, we always work pretty much in harmony, and, you know, everybody's pulling the same rope, really, if you like.
Martin, I wish you lots of luck on your cycle tour.
Thank you.
And also when you go to South Africa later this year to meet the descendants of those people from the Mendi.
Thank you, John. I'm going to enjoy that. And I should have gone down there in 95. That all fell apart. So hopefully it'll all work this year. Thank you.
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
You're a bit late, Mr. Hodges. It's all over now. What would Captain Mannering say? You've been listening to a John Hannum Meets original podcast. Bye-bye for now. Isle of Wight Radio.